Okay, if we get started. For those of you who weren't here, first off, I'll introduce myself. I'm Dean Baker. Thanks for coming. This is our second session, the Center for Economic and Policy Research's seminar series on basic economics, and this one will focus on growth. We'll have a second session on growth next week that will focus on the developing countries. This one will focus on primarily talk about developed countries, but a lot of the concepts, basic concepts of growth are common to both. Just a couple things about the ground, you know, the conduct. I'll go for about 45 minutes and then stop and give everyone a chance to take a break for a few minutes, about 5 minutes, and then we'll take questions. So I'd ask that you refrain unless I say something that seems completely off the wall or a slide doesn't seem to make sense or something really seems wrong. If you could wait until the questions to ask questions. Secondly, during the question period, I'd appreciate if you would restrict it to questions. If you have comments, want to raise issues, I'd be happy to talk to people afterwards, but I really do want to give people a chance to ask questions. I'd just stick to questions during that period. And the last thing is, if you have cell phones, please turn them off. We don't want cell phones going off in the middle. We are taping and recording this for posterity, too, so we do hope to not have it interrupted by cell phones. Okay, so to start with, let me just outline the things I wanted to cover. First off, in terms of talking about growth, I want to give you some brief definitions. I won't go into great length. I won't try and make you experts on national income accounting, but I do just want to briefly explain what the concept is, what gets counted, what doesn't get counted. Secondly, to talk about the link between growth and jobs and productivity and wages. This is at the core of why, you know, I will say I think growth is in general good. So I'll make that point. I'll say also that it's not always good or not everything about it's good and certainly not the whole story. The third point, that if we compare the United States and Europe, we hear comparisons all the time, usually to make Europe sound bad. If you've been reading in the news, you all know that Germany's about to collapse. They've been saying that for decades. But, you know, the news this week, they just had elections there, so there were all these things about how if Germany doesn't reform, its economy will collapse. I will say that at least that's not obviously true, and give a little bit about comparisons between the United States and Europe that don't show Europe necessarily doing worse than the United States. And the last thing about growth and regulations and public spending, what I want to talk about there is how standard economic models treat regulation and public spending, because it's important to understand, not endorsing their models, but all the time you see arguments made that things that a lot of us might like, if we want to see a redistributional policy, we want to raise taxes on wealthy people to pay for, you know, child care for poor people or something like that. Standard economic models will typically show that that reduces growth and costs jobs. If we have environmental regulations, standard economic models will show that that reduces growth and costs jobs. So I want to say a little bit about what's the logic of that, how they get that result, and a few twists that we could take on that, because we shouldn't always be defensive about that, as tends to be the case. Okay, so starting off, definitions, what gets counted in growth? Okay, there are four major categories: consumption, investment, government spending, and net exports. So this is just, you know, again, I won't bore you with great detail, but just to understand what gets counted in gross domestic product, which is, you know, sort of our standard measure of growth. Consumption is the largest component. What gets counted are pretty much anything we might buy. So this is all the goods and services we might buy. So if you get a car, the rent on your apartment, if you own a house, we impute a rent to it. Medical care gets counted. You pay for medical services, whatever those might be. You go to a restaurant, that gets counted. College tuition gets counted. If you pay for daycare, you know, on down the list, you know, the chairs we buy, just about anything that you might imagine spending money on, the vast majority of those things get counted in consumption. I won't worry about the ones that don't. But basically, anything you could envision spending money on gets counted as consumption. Investment, what gets counted investment? Basically, sort of a simple way to think of what investment is, that's what firms spend money on. So if a firm builds a new factory, builds a new shopping mall, builds a new office building, if they get equipment, they get new computers, software counts as investment. So for the most part, it's things that firms spend money on. The one type of investment that individuals typically do is housing. Housing counts as investment. So if I buy a new home, that counts as investment. Okay, so that's sort of basic start investment. Let me make a point here about what doesn't get counted as investment. Buying stock doesn't get counted as investment. Okay, and there's an interesting logic here, important logic here. Buying stock isn't directly a good or service. If I buy, you know, 1,000 shares of Microsoft stock, all I'm buying is a sheet of paper. Okay, so I haven't, there's no good or service that corresponds to that. We're trying to measure newly produced goods and services. Buying stock isn't a newly produced good or service. What happens is, you know, someone here sells me 1,000 shares of Microsoft. I give you, you know, whatever it sells for, $100,000. And you give me a certificate that says I now have 1,000 shares of Microsoft. So there's nothing that's produced that corresponds to that. Now, there's a deeper logic that I'm not going to go into, but in principle, one could say, okay, if Microsoft's stock gets really high, then Microsoft might issue more shares of stock, and then they'll maybe use that money to go out and start a whole new line of software or something like that. You know, so maybe that would happen. And when they do that, that would be investment. Okay, that's a very, very weak, tenuous link, but the point is, buying a sheet of paper is not investment. That's just, you know, I own one sheet of paper or sets of sheet of paper, $100,000 bills, and then I own shares of stock, just sheets of paper floating around. That's not investment. Okay, third thing that gets counted, government spending. It's, you know, important to keep in mind that it is part of the economy. So, you know, when the Republicans always want to cut government because, you know, that won't slow growth, well, government's part of the economy. So government spending, if we think of direct government spending, when we're educating kids, we're, you know, if we have government-provided daycare centers, government hospitals, whatever those are, that's all part of GDP. So is defense spending. Okay, what doesn't get counted in this is the transfer payment. So if the government sends someone a Social Security check, that's not counted as part of GDP because, again, it's sheets of paper floating around. If I get a Social Security check from the government, then I use that to pay my rent. That, of course, counts as consumption. That's part of GDP. Use some of it to pay for hospital bills, whatever it might be. That gets counted as part of GDP. The check doesn't get counted. When the government sends me the check for my Social Security, that doesn't get counted. Okay, so what we're looking at here is actually goods and services, things that are going to employ people, okay, not sheets of paper floating around. The last thing that gets counted in here is net exports. And important thing to keep in mind, it's net exports. So when we export something, if we're producing, you know, wheat and we sell that to Mexico or China, wherever we might sell it, the wheat gets counted as part of GDP. Okay, so all our exports get counted. Okay, imports are subtracted. Okay, so we're buying computers that were made in Taiwan. We're getting steel from Mexico. Okay, that's subtracted from GDP. Okay, the reason for that, the logic of it, it's fairly simple. If I count the computer, we're trying to measure the goods and services that are produced in the United States. So I go out and buy a computer today, that gets counted consumption. That's part of GDP. But it turns out that computer wasn't made here. It was made in China. Okay, so then we subtract that on the import side. Okay, my reason for taking a moment to emphasize this is because a lot of politicians like to play games and go, look at all the jobs we created with exports. Okay, and you could say, okay, that's fine. We create jobs with exports. But we've lost a lot more with imports. Okay, we actually have a very large trade deficit I'll come to in a moment. But for every job that we create with exports, we often lose a lot of jobs with imports, and sometimes it's almost virtually the same story. So, for example, a lot of our exports are now associated with exporting goods that get assembled elsewhere. We export a lot of car parts to Mexico so that the car gets assembled in Mexico, taking advantage of low-cost labor in Mexico, and then gets brought back to the United States. So if I'm Bill Clinton, I want to say, hey, NAFTA was a really great success. Look at all our jobs created in exports. I point to all the jobs that were created in exporting car parts to Mexico. But that's kind of bogus because we really didn't create the jobs. Before, the cars used to be assembled in Detroit. Now they're assembled somewhere in Mexico. So that didn't create jobs. That were simply shipping the parts to Mexico to be assembled. Okay, so the full story, of course, is exports minus imports. And that net story, we're a job loser. At least, you know, sort of just the simple arithmetic. Okay, so it's important to keep that in mind. As I say, a lot of politicians like to play games in that, and they only take the exports. We always say that's kind of like if you went to a baseball game, you go, how we do? We go, oh, we got 3 runs. You know, the other team got 20. You know, but that's kind of what they end up doing in the trade. They just like to take one side of the scorecard. Okay, next thing, just to give you an idea of the relative importance of these different categories. Consumption is most of the story. Consumption is over 70% of our GDP. It's about 73, 74. That's most of the story in GDP. Investment is somewhere around 17%. Again, that includes, this is from 2004, by the way, so it will vary a little bit year by year. It doesn't vary too much, but, you know, if I showed you 2000, investment would, well, probably be about the same, actually, because housing was
lower, but other investment was higher. But it would vary a little bit year to year. But, you know, if I, let's say I went back to 94, you might have, it would still be pretty much the same. Investment might be a little lower in 94. But it's pretty much the same year to year. So as a general rule, consumption is somewhere around 70% of GDP. Investment, 15, 16, 17%. Government spending, roughly the same. What we have is an unusual situation. This gets back to what I was saying a moment ago. We have negative net exports. So if we summed investment, government spending, and consumption, we come to about 105% of GDP. The reason for that is that our net exports are negative. Okay, we're importing a lot more than we're exporting. Currently, we're importing about $700 billion a year, just under 6% of GDP, more than we're exporting. Okay, this is the trade deficit that, you know, I'll have more occasion to talk about, not in this session, but we'll be talking about in other sessions. But this is the trade deficit that, you know, to me at least, is a very, very big problem, bigger problem than the government budget deficit. It doesn't get very much attention, but it's a very big problem. We'll pay a price for it later. Okay, but the long and short is because the other three are so, because the trade deficit, we have a large trade deficit, the other three categories add to over 100%. It adds to about, as I say, about 105, 105 and a half. Okay, next thing, what gets missed from GDP? One of the things to keep in mind that we're looking at marketed goods and services. GDP will miss when you go from producing something at home to buying it. I shouldn't say miss, it will pick it up. And it's something that, you know, may seem somewhat deceptive in the sense that, you know, if we have, imagine the traditional family, the stay-at-home mom, you know, so, you know, the mother stays at home with the kid, you know, the father goes out and works. Okay, obviously the mother's doing productive work, caring for the kid, maybe cooking meals at home, then the mother goes to work. So we get a shift from, you know, the traditional family to the two-worker household, the more typical situation these days. Well, that will look like you have an increase in GDP because now, you know, let's say the kid goes to a daycare center. Well, that's a market transaction. Like, it's counting GDP. The kid's not necessarily better off by it. You know, I mean, they're being cared for, at least hopefully they're being cared for. So it hasn't changed. Maybe they're buying their, you know, it used to be the case that they prepared food at home that's now purchased, that gets counted GDP. Obviously, household production, if, you know, someone's cooking at home, that's not counted GDP. So that's one way in which your GDP might go up that isn't, at least on the face of it, a benefit. You know, if you have the same goods and services being produced, but now they're purchased in the market as opposed to, you know, being done in a household production. Okay, so that would get counted GDP. What doesn't get counted in GDP, there's lots of bad things. You know, there's no subtractions for crime. In fact, the opposite, if we, you know, we're paying about 1% of our GDP goes to pay for our criminal justice system, put people behind bars, pay for parole officers, people monitoring probation, the courts. That takes up about 1% of GDP. So that actually raises GDP. So we have higher GDP for that. There's no subtraction for crime. You could say the same about military spending. Obviously, currently military spending is over 4% of GDP. Okay, so there's no subtraction there. Pollution, sometimes, obviously, GDP is accompanied by pollution. There's no subtractions. Any other form of environmental degradation, there's no subtractions for that. One of the arguments I sometimes get in with people say, well, growth is bad because it's associated with pollution, it's associated with crime. And I'll defend growth in that because you can have pollution without growth. I mean, suppose the U.S. economy were to stagnate so we had no growth for the next decade. There's no reason to think we're going to have less pollution because of that. Okay, and we can have growth associated with less pollution because suppose we got everyone to go out and get, you know, more fuel-efficient cars. You know, so instead of getting, you know, these SUVs that get, you know, 15 miles to a gallon, you know, we somehow got everyone tomorrow to go out and get a hybrid that gets 35 or 40 miles to a gallon. You know, it could be associated with less pollution. It doesn't have to be, but it can be. Okay. The most important thing, though, is just that, you know, I'd say is that growth, it's not a comprehensive measure. So it's just, you know, someone says, you know, the economy's growing, that's great news. Well, if I hear an economy's not growing, I'd probably say that's bad news. But, you know, just because it's growing, that's not necessarily great news. If the U.S. economy were growing because defense spending had doubled, so we're involved in wars all over the place, you know, that wouldn't be great news. You know, so it doesn't mean that it's great news. It's not intended to be a comprehensive measure of well-being. So if someone wants to say that, you know, it's not a complete measure of well-being, that's absolutely right. I mean, if you think of it as analogous to something like cholesterol. I mean, other things equal, it's better to have lower cholesterol than higher cholesterol. I mean, you know, wouldn't you rather have lower cholesterol? But on the other hand, just because you have low cholesterol doesn't mean you're healthy.
Okay, so it's the same sort of thing. It's measuring something very specific. It tells us something about the economy. I'll come back in a second and talk about the links between growth and jobs, which is, you know, very, very important. But the point is, it's not a comprehensive measure of well-being. So we should never think that, you know, we can look at GDP and say, okay, our GDP is really high. That means, you know, we're a great country. Everyone's very happy. Things are doing well. On the other hand, if we see GDP is not growing, I'd say, you know, at least at first blush, you probably have a problem. Not always, but, you know, at least at first blush, I'd say you probably have a problem. Okay, and I'll come back and talk a little bit about that more when I do comparisons with Europe. Okay, next point, growth and jobs, more growth, more jobs. Simple, kind of almost stupid thing to say, but it's important to keep in mind that just, you know, sort of as a first approximation, the more growth we have, the more jobs are being created. So, you know, if the economy grows 4% next year rather than 3%, odds are we'll see more jobs. Okay, it's not one-to-one. I'll come back to that in a second. But other things equal, you know, if you get more growth, you get more jobs. And, you know, like most people, I think most of us want to see people have jobs. At least people want jobs, have them. So as a first approximation, you know, I think you should want more growth. Okay, and this graph shows in general the link. And what you see is, you know, we started in 1960, that the periods where you have, you know, little or no growth, these are the recessions. So if you look in the mid-70s, you see that the economy levels off. You look at the early 80s, the economy levels off, actually falls. You see that, you know, the number of jobs levels off or falls. Early 90s, the economy levels off, growth levels off. The number of jobs also levels off. Okay, actually it falls slightly. So, you know, sort of it's a simple story. When you have growth, you get more jobs. Okay, and if the economy doesn't grow, you don't get jobs, you actually lose jobs. Okay, so we have these periodic recessions. You know, the early 70s we had more, mid-70s, early 80s, early 90s. Seem to go at the beginning of decades for no obvious reason. That you have recessions where you have very little growth, or no growth, I should say, negative growth. And you have a period where you get little or no job creation or actually lose jobs. Okay, second point in this, part of growth, part of the story, when we think of the output of the economy, on the one hand, we have jobs in terms of, you know, how many people are working. The other part is how much they produce for each hour of work, and that's the basic story of productivity. Productivity asks, in effect, a very simple question. What does the average worker produce? How much goods and services is the average worker producing in an hour of work? Okay, and again, just as I would say with growth, sort of as a first approximation, what you could say is, you know, the more productivity you have per hour, the more, you know, more output you get for each hour of work, generally the better. I mean, there might be exceptions to that, but in general, you know, we'd rather work fewer hours than more. So if we can produce more in an hour of work, that's good news. Now, usually what we would say is that productivity most immediately gets translated into higher wages. And what I've shown here is productivity growth, compensation growth, and wage growth over the last 40 years or 45 years. And my reason for doing this, I'm distinguishing compensation and wages. What we see is, for the most part, if we go back before the 70s and before the mid-70s, compensation growth and productivity growth were almost the same. Now, the difference between compensation and wages is primarily health care benefits. Also, this would include pension benefits. There's a few other non-wage things that would fall in there. But the bulk of the difference between compensation growth and wage growth is health care benefits and pension benefits. Okay, now, compensation growth had tracked productivity growth very closely until the 80s. We get an increasing divergence between compensation growth and productivity growth as you get out into the 90s, and particularly in the most recent few years. What that means is that workers are not getting their share of output. Okay, compensation isn't keeping pace with productivity growth, and they're not getting their share. What's going on? The profit share is increasing. Okay, so this is particularly true of, say, the last 10 years or so, that we've had an increase in the profit share at the expense of compensation. Okay, so workers are losing, firms are gaining. Okay, so that's part of the story of the last 10 years, that workers' compensation has not kept pace with productivity growth. Okay, that was generally not the case if we go back to prior decades. In general, compensation tracked productivity growth reasonably well. Now, the second part of the story here, the second line, is wages.
Okay, and as you can see, wage growth is not tracking compensation very well at all. Okay, and what's going on there is, to the largest extent, increasing healthcare costs. Okay, so what's happened here is that wages, we've had an increasing share of the wage bill going for healthcare costs, and as a result of that, wages have been falling far behind productivity growth. Now, I'm actually forgetting as I look at this whether I'm showing this for the average worker or the median, which would make a difference as well, and the point, and I believe I've actually shown wages for the median worker here, but I have to confess I can't remember for sure. Because part of this story here is that the median worker, the typical worker, worker in the middle of the wage distribution, actually has been losing relative to high-end workers. So a phenomenon of the last 25 years, the last quarter century, doctors, lawyers, the lobbyists on the Hill, they've been doing very well. Typical workers have not been doing very well. So in addition to losing a lot of money in healthcare benefits, you also have typical workers losing out to high-end workers. Okay, so we have three ways in which typical workers have been losing over the last, particularly 10 years, but to some extent the last quarter century. To some extent, workers have been losing because we've had a shift from wages to profits. That's the gap between compensation and productivity. To some extent, workers have been losing because healthcare costs have been growing so much. They're a much larger share of the wage bill. And to some extent, typical workers, a worker in the middle of the wage distribution, have been losing out to higher-end workers. So money for, you know, assembly line workers, school teachers, that's been shifting instead to doctors, lawyers, higher-end people who have been gaining at their expense. Okay, and that's... Okay, the point, this all sort of comes home in the recent recovery, or recession recovery. We've had an unusual period over the last 5 years. As I said, usually you get GDP growth accompanied by job growth, accompanied by productivity growth, accompanied by wage growth. What we've seen in the most recent period, the last 5 years, is that we've had decent productivity growth, we've had weak wage growth, we've had decent consumption growth. I'll just jump ahead. But it's been driven by debt. Okay, so if we go from 2000 to 2005, the total growth, the cumulative growth in wages has been less than 5% adjusted for inflation. So this is a five-year period, very, very weak wage growth. Okay, and the average hourly wage has been, it's risen a little bit, but virtually flat over that five-year period. Consumption growth, on the other hand, has grown at a respectable pace. So consumption is up by about 15% over this five-year period. Okay, so we've had pretty decent growth in consumption. Okay, but what's driven that? It's been household debt. Okay, so this has been a very unusual period. We've had this huge run-up in household debt, of over a 40% increase in household debt over this five-year period. So what's happened is people are increasing their consumption, not because they have more income from their wages. Instead, what's going on is that basically they're borrowing more. First and foremost, people are borrowing a lot of money against their homes. Okay, again, we have a session later in this series where I'll talk about financial bubbles, and the bubble now is the housing market. What's happened is housing prices have gone through the roof, and people borrow against their homes. So what we've had in the last 5 years is a recovery that's been driven not in the typical way where we can talk about a virtuous cycle where you get job growth, you get productivity growth, you get wage growth, you get consumption growth, more job growth. Instead, what we've had is we've had very little job growth, we had very weak wage growth. Instead, we've had people borrowing money, increasing consumption, and that's what's kept the economy going. It's not a healthy path, and it's clearly not the normal path. It's not what we've seen in any prior post-war recovery. So it's something really unusual, and I mean, I won't go into this in detail today, but something that, you know, on the face of it doesn't sound very sustainable. Okay. Europe versus the U.S., basically, what I want to make the case here is that, you know, the main difference between Europe and the U.S. isn't that our economy works and theirs doesn't. It's simply that in Europe, they've opted to take the benefits of productivity growth more in leisure, whereas in the United States, we end up taking it more in higher income SUVs and the like. Okay. And next slide, just the basic picture. Per capita income, we're at the top. Okay, our per capita income is close to $40,000, about $38,000.
By the way, these are put on, I won't get into that. I was going to say these are purchasing power parity. I won't go into great detail what that is. But this is the best effort. If you're trying to do an honest comparison of per capita income, this is what you would use. I won't go into how you could use a dishonest one. Okay, the United States at the top. Norway is second. By the way, the New York Times did this piece. I know this is a digression, but the New York Times did this piece about 4 months ago, trashing the people in Norway because they think they're rich. And this guy was going on about how much it costs to buy a drink in a bar in Norway. Well, they have very high taxes on alcohol because they want to discourage people from consuming it. So he's complaining about that, and there are a few other things he's complaining about, and he's going, but the people in Norway somehow think they're rich, and they don't know what they're talking about. This is from the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. Last I heard, not big lefties or anything, you know. They're about as mainstream as you get, you know, and this is their data. So, you know, it's kind of funny to read this piece in the New York Times where the whole gist of the piece was people in Norway have somehow gotten in the head that they're rich. Well, this is what the data shows. So this guy was unhappy because he had to spend a lot of money to get a drink in a bar. But, anyhow, so that's all a digression. But yes, the U.S. ranks at the top in per capita GDP. As you can see, in some countries, obviously Norway is not very far away. You have a few other countries that are fairly close, Switzerland, Ireland, Denmark. You know, they're not too far down. But if you want to take a broad area, the Euro area, that's the area we always make fun of, you know, that's old Europe, mostly old Europe, as President Bush would have it, they're about 20% less. So if we take per capita GDPs, compare the United States to old Europe, old Europe, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, you know, most of continental Europe is in that Eurozone area, that's old Europe, they have about 20% less per capita GDP. So first blush, you know, they have about 80% of the income per person as we do. Okay, well, why is that? Well, the biggest reason is we work a lot more. Okay, so this is the number of hours we work a year. It's about 1,800, a little more than 1,800. If you look at old Europe, they're not working very much. Okay, in Germany, they work a little over 1,400. France works here less than 1,400. Even less in Netherlands and Norway. Okay, even less than 1,400 hours a year. Okay, well, what's going on there? Well, if you look at old Europe, they have mandates, they have government mandates that say that every worker has to have 5 weeks a year vacation. Actually, as part of the European Union, every country, they're obligated to have at least 4 weeks. Most countries have more, but all the countries of the European Union have to provide their workers with at least 4 weeks a year vacation. As I say, many of the countries, in law, you have to have, you know, 5 weeks and some even more. Denmark, you know, had a national strike because they had 5 weeks and the unions there were demanding six and they got, I think, three additional days or something like that. So I like the idea that you had a whole country striking for 6 weeks of vacation. Okay, so that's the biggest difference. They have, you know, they have more vacation. They also have shorter work weeks. In France, the norm is a 35-hour work week. It's hotly debated. They recently instituted that, I think it was 97 or 98 that they instituted a 35-hour work week, and the current, they have a conservative government wants to go back on it, and they have a little bit, but you know, the normal work week there is somewhere around 35 hours. You find similar things in Germany, other countries. It's common for people to get off Friday afternoon, so they work a 4.5-day week. So they tend to have a shorter work week and also more weeks. As I said, they have vacation here. Obviously, there's no law requiring anyone any vacation at all. If you have a good employer, you know, if you have a higher-paying job, odds are you get vacation. But if you work at Walmart, odds are you don't have vacation. Because a lot of people are working at jobs where they never get a paid day off, and, you know, they're not, employers aren't even obligated to give them unpaid days off. They can just tell them, you don't come in, you're fired. Okay, so that's the biggest difference. And another way to see that, if you look at productivity, how much you produce per hour, okay, the productivity of European workers per hour, it's not very different than the U.S., and some countries in Europe actually have higher productivity per hour. So Norway, France, their output per hour is higher than the United States. Okay, Belgium, you know, old European countries, Netherlands. I guess Netherlands is part of the coalition of the willing, so that makes them new Europe, I guess. But otherwise, one might think of them as old Europe. So they actually have higher productivity. So in terms of output per hour, Europe is very close to the United States if you take Europe as a whole. We have them on here as a whole somewhere. Thought we had them on there. Okay, maybe we don't have Europe as a whole. You can see Germany is just a little bit below the United States. I should be straight with that on Germany. That's taking former West Germany. Okay, Okay, so if you want to make Germany look bad, you always include former East Germany, which, you know, admittedly they haven't done a great job integrating, but on the other hand, you know, imagine in 1991 we had taken over Mexico and we were trying to bring Mexico up to U.S. living standards. I suspect it would take us a few years. So that's similar to what Germany has done in, you know, annexing East Germany, and it would look much worse if we included all of Germany. Okay, but what you can see is that in terms of what they produce per hour, it's pretty comparable to what the U.S. does, and as I say, some of the countries, France, Belgium, they're actually higher than the U.S. So the basic question, how are they doing, productivity is probably a better thing to look at than per capita GDP, because I have no reason, or I should say, as an economist, I have no reason to be telling people in Europe that they should work more. That's their decision. And if they decide they would rather take the benefits of their productivity growth in vacation time, shorter work weeks, well, where do economists get off telling them that's a bad thing? That's their choice. Okay, and they elect governments that support that, that do that, put that into law. There's no reason on earth for economists to say that's a bad thing. I mean, I might not like it, but, you know, as an economist, that's just my personal opinion. You know, that's not like they've done a wrong thing by opting to take more leisure and to work less. Okay. The last thing I wanted to get to is, what are the main determinants of economic growth in the standard model? And I want to spend a little time on this because we see this all the time in policy debates, and we get beaten up on it all the time in policy debates, and really wrongly. I think it's really important for people to understand what these models are. You know, so in a certain sense, like, there should never be any surprises when you look at standard economic models. I don't even have to look at an analysis. I mean, I might not know the exact number, but I could tell you what it will show. Okay, because it's almost by definition. Basically, the standard economic models, when I'm saying standard economic models, if I went to any of the major forecasting firms, the biggest one now is Global Insights, but, you know, there's nothing unique about them. There's, you know, many econometric economic forecasting firms. They all use the same sorts of models. They all give you the same sorts of results. So if I went to one of them, I said, you know, well, I'll just go through the specific policies. So suppose, you know, I wanted to raise taxes. You know, I thought it was a good idea to take back President Bush's tax cut. Okay, what will that show? Well, I can tell you. It's going to show that it's going to mean, you know, less growth and fewer jobs. The reason why is that the models always start from the assumption that the market leads to the best possible outcomes. Okay, so anything that interferes with the market, we have taxes in there, anything that interferes with the market is going to mean less economic growth and fewer jobs. It's almost definitional. So what's going to happen if I, you know, put in, you know, raise taxes or take back the tax cut, however you want to call it, it's going to mean that, you know, there's now more of a tax on high-income people. They'll work less, or they'll save less, they'll invest less, or there'll be less investment in the economy, so there'll be less growth and less jobs. Virtually guaranteed. I mean, if you did the model right, the standard models. I'm not endorsing the models, by the way. I want to point out, I'm not saying that this necessarily says anything true about the world, but I'm just saying the models that, you know, 99.9% of economists will accept, those assume that, you know, by definition, if we raise taxes, then we will end up with less growth and fewer jobs. Spending, same story. Okay, if, you know, we say, why don't we spend more on education? Okay, the standard thing that will jump out of these models is less growth and fewer jobs. Now, you will get a few models. Is this really pressing?
Government spending, you mean, don't you?
Government spending, yes. Thank you for saying that. Yes, government spending. So if we say it'd be a really good idea for the government to extend Head Start to cover everyone, okay, that would, you know, almost all these models mean less growth and fewer jobs. You will occasionally get someone who will be, you know, generous enough to say, well, maybe education has some return, you know, so that, you know, 10 years out or 15 years out, these people will be more productive workers. That would be the exception. You can occasionally get someone to put that in a model. But just as a general rule, we want to spend more on something. We want to, you know, make sure that kids have child care, you know, Head Start, you know, improve our infrastructure. The general rule is that you'll have less growth and fewer jobs. Trade barriers. You know, when President Clinton or President Bush wanted to push NAFTA, CAFTA, they go, you know, our models show that will mean, you know, more growth, more jobs. That is almost by definition, because, you know, currently we have a tariff barrier or we have a quota, so we're going to remove that. So, you know, less government interference in the economy, that's going to mean more growth and more jobs, you know. Or if you take it the other way, if we were to talk about raising them, we want to have a tariff to protect our steel workers, you know, because they're getting beaten up. You know, we did this a few years ago, Bush put a tariff temporarily on steel for a few years ago, for a few years. In the models, almost by definition, it's going to lead to less growth and fewer jobs. Last thing in that category, environmental regulations, government regulations. If we have consumer regulations, if we have restrictions on building, if we have restriction on greenhouse gas emissions, again, almost by definition, it's going to lead to less growth and fewer jobs. So, you know, it shouldn't be a surprise. You know, when someone goes off and says, we're going to model this, again, we'll have to see exactly the numbers they come up with, but it's virtually guaranteed that all of these things will mean less growth and fewer jobs. Okay, point to be made about this is you really have to understand what exactly is going on in these models. Okay, you got to go in time. when you have less growth and fewer jobs in these models, it's actually a strange sense of people not having jobs. What determines level of employment and job in these models, no one is ever involuntarily unemployed in these models. Okay, it's a very, very strange sense. You're going to think I'm really weird on telling you this, but it really is what goes on in these models. What's going on is people are opting not to work at the prevailing wage. So the idea is that we don't have anyone in these models that's involuntarily unemployed. Not to say that never happens. There could be a short period, 6 months, a year, 2 years, but if we look out over 10 years, no one is ever involuntarily unemployed. What's going on is that we have some number of people that they see they can get $10 an hour, and they go, well, for 10 bucks an hour, I'd rather sit home and watch TV. Okay. On the other hand, if the wage were higher, let's say it went to 10.10 an hour, 1% higher, then, well, for 10.10 an hour, I would make a decision to work. Okay, it's important to understand that because in that model, well, let me just jump ahead to the next one. Just did the arithmetic on that. In that model, unemployment is not at all what we ordinarily think of as unemployment. I mean, at least that's not what I think of. So when I think of people being unemployed, you know, I think of auto workers in Michigan that have lost their job. You know, I think of, you know, people who are working as clerical workers who've lost their job, people in the airline industry, you know, flight attendants or, you know, mechanics, they've lost their job and they can't get another job at 1% lower pay. That's not it. They can't find a job. Maybe they can get a job at Walmart at, you know, 1/3 the pay. But it's not as though they've made a decision that, you know, well, I was willing to work as a mechanic for Northwest or Delta, who's ever letting them off this week. I was willing to work there for 12 an hour, but now I'd have to work for $11.88, and that's not worth it to me, so I'm going to stay home and watch TV. I don't think that's what's going on. I don't think that's what many of us think is going on. But in these models, when we talk about people being unemployed, that is what's going on. Okay, and the logic of this is, it all works, it all makes sense. The logic of it is that people get paid based on their efficiency of the economy. So what's in effect happening when we throw a tax in there, you know, we raise taxes this year, is we've like thrown a monkey wrench in the economy. We've made it less efficient. Okay, same thing, put an environmental regulation on. So, you know, we say you can't emit as much greenhouse gases. We've made the economy less efficient. So what that means is before, my wage used to be $10 an hour because that was how efficient I was. If I worked for an hour, I produced $10 of output. Okay, but now we threw the wrench into the economy, so I'm somewhat less efficient. The economy's less efficient, I'm less efficient, and I only produce $9.90 an hour. Okay, so we've thrown this monkey wrench into the economy to make it less efficient. Therefore, you know, I've lowered the wage, and at $9.90 an hour, I'm not willing to work. Okay, my reason for going into this in a little detail is, one, we should never be surprised what comes out of these models. Someone says, I'm going to go and see what it does in an economic model. You can go ahead and do it, but you already will know what is going to come out of there. You want to raise taxes, it's going to look bad. You want to spend more on some government program, it's going to look bad. You want to have some pollution regulation, it's going to look bad. Guaranteed. We don't know the exact number. That's what they're going to tell you when it comes out of the model. Okay, but that's what it's going to tell you. Second point is that the unemployment that is in those models is not, at least what I think of as real-world unemployment. I don't think it's what most people think is real-world unemployment. That's a very important point, I think, because if I really thought, as these models suggest, that, you know, what's going on is we had some workers that were willing to work for 10 bucks an hour at $9.90, it's not worth their while, so they've opted to sit home on their couch, that wouldn't really bother me that much. I mean, that's really what I thought was going on with unemployment. Okay, that is what these models imply, though. So it's important to understand. It's not real-world unemployment as we think of it, or at least as I think of it. It's people getting paid a little bit less. And, you know, basically in these models, if you know, going from $10 to $9.90 determines whether they're willing to work or not. Well, that's no difference from going from $10.20 to $10.10. They're getting paid a little less. They're still working in that story, but they're getting paid a little less. I'd rather get paid more than get paid less. But, you know, most of us wouldn't think that is a disaster, okay, if their pay fell 10 cents an hour, 1%. Okay, but that's the sort of story that you have embedded in these models. So it's just important we get beat up with these things all the time. And it's just important to understand where they're coming from, how they get their results, what they mean. The last point that I want to make on this is simply, we have to learn to flip this around. Things we may not like also cost jobs in their models. Defense spending will cost jobs in their models. And one of the things I would love to do, we've never had anyone willing to pay for this, but I would love to sometime hire one of the major econometric forecasting firms and say, we increase defense spending by $100 billion a year, you know, or 1%, $120 billion a year, go back to 2000. You know, we were spending around $300 billion a year, now we're spending about $450 billion, adjust for inflation or whatever. It's about 1% of GDP. Okay, so we increased our defense budget by an amount equal to about 1% of GDP. What does that do to employment? In these models, it will cut employment, and probably by quite a lot. Okay, everyone thinks defense spending creates jobs because we all think in the world, of course, it does to some extent. Obviously, you know, if we were spending that additional $120 billion a year on defense, we're employing people at the factories where they're making the tanks, making the planes, you know, making the ammunition, all these different things. That obviously creates jobs. It creates jobs in the real world. But in these models, what does that do? That pulls resources away from their most productive uses. So you plug a $100 billion, $120 billion increase in the annual defense budget into the standard models, I'll guarantee you it will cost jobs, probably around a million jobs. Okay, a lot of jobs, because it's going to lower, it makes the economy less efficient. It's just the same, you throw into one of these models and you spend $120 billion a year on defense spending, it's the same thing as spending it on schools. You know, it's pulling money from its most productive use in their models to a less productive use. Okay, defense spending, it's not even a value judgment, it's not whether we think it's a good thing or bad thing, but the point is you've pulled the money out of the normal economy. You've pulled it out of the productive economy, and the government's using it. It's the same as from an economic standpoint if they just threw it in the garbage. Okay, so they're taxing people to throw money in the garbage. Okay, and that would lower GDP, lower growth. Okay, so one of the things, as I say, I would love to do sometime is to simply run that in one of these models so that we had that as a basis of comparison. So, you know, we could say, you know, what do you think of increasing defense spending knowing that it costs, you know, 1 million jobs? The reason for saying that, again, it's, you know, we may want to beat up on defense spending, but apart from that, it's important to understand that it's not, you know, just because something costs jobs doesn't mean that, you know, it's necessarily bad. You have to ask what the goal is. And, you know, if I thought it was really important that we were fighting in Iraq, if we thought that was really important, then you probably say, well, if it costs jobs, that's worth it, you know. But the question is, you know, what's the trade-off here? Simply because it costs jobs doesn't mean that it's necessarily something that you wouldn't want to do. Okay, so just to sum up, again, just to repeat the basic point, I would say in general, more growth is better. That doesn't mean that, you know, we always want more growth no matter what. You know, if people opt to take, you know, they'd rather have 35-hour work weeks, they'd rather have 6 weeks vacation, I think that's great. Okay, but if you just told me here are two economies, one grew at 5% last year, one grew at 1%, I'd say, well, at first glance at least, probably the 5% is better. Okay, but there could be reasons on closer, you know, investigation that, you know, 1%, the economy that grew 1% is doing better than the economy that grew at 5%. The second point, you know, economic growth is not a comprehensive measure of well-being, you know, so it's not, you know, the people who criticize GDP and say it doesn't tell us everything, that's absolutely right. You know, GDP is telling us one very specific thing. It's telling us how much is being produced in the economy. So if it's being produced in a way that's leading to environmental degradation, you know, everyone's unhealthy, I'm not going to tell you it's a good story. You know, it isn't. It isn't. It also doesn't tell you anything about distribution. So if the economy is growing and the only people getting, you know, benefiting from that are those at the top end, well, that's not a very good picture either. Okay, so it's very far from a comprehensive measure of well-being, and anyone who tries to present it as that, you know, basically doesn't know what they're talking about. It's just telling you one very specific thing.
third point, you know, again, this is important, not just because, I mean, I don't have to defend Europe. There's plenty of Europeans to defend Europe, but there's lots of things about Europe that I like, at least. And when people say, well, you know, do you want to have national health care insurance, then you're like Europe. Well, that's why it's important to defend Europe in arguments here, because, you know, Europe is not a disaster story. You know, you're free to say you like things better about the U.S. and Europe. I don't, you know, that's fine. But the point is, their economy is not about to collapse. It's not a disaster story. In most ways, it's pretty comparable to the U.S. The biggest difference is that they've opted to take more leisure and less income. And that's fine if someone doesn't like that, but the Europeans happen to think differently, and that's their choice. Okay, so the people who try to tell you that, you know, you get a disaster if you have a developed welfare state, if you have education for your kids, if you have child care for your kids, you have health care. No, you don't get a disaster. Okay, they're doing just fine. And the last point, we can have trade-offs for growth, you know, so we can say, you know, yeah, maybe in these models that if we regulate greenhouse gas emissions, it will show somewhat slower growth. So what? So what? The Republicans are happy, you know, all of them are out there. Some Democrats, they'll support the war in Iraq. That costs jobs. All of them are willing to support something that costs, I'll use the term a million. I don't know what the models will actually show, but my guess is on that order. They were willing to cost 1 million jobs so that they could occupy Iraq. Okay, so suppose we want to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, and Global Insights tells us that will cost 1 million jobs. Okay, so we could say it will cost as many jobs as invading and occupying Iraq did. Okay, what, is that worth it or not? Well, in my view, it is, but I mean, you know, someone else could call it. But the more important point is, all the time we do things that cost jobs in these standard models. Usually that's never raised as an argument because we aren't hiring the economists to show that. Okay, but, you know, we shouldn't let them beat us up and say, oh no, we can't have any environmental regulations, we can't possibly tax rich people, you know, we can't have worker regulations that guarantee people, you know, paid time off or whatever it be, because that will cost jobs. Fine, you know, they do things all the time that cost jobs. We might want to do things too. Okay, so I'll stop for a break there, and let's try and restrict it about 5 minutes and take questions.